So thank you all for coming today. This is going to be the most exciting session, as you know, talking about the regulatory frameworks for technologies is scintillating and far more exciting than actual field work. I mean, no offense, guys, but this is the stuff. Something really extraordinary happened today that with this executive order that I think is it touches on a couple of things that we're going to go over today. But each one of the panelists, we're going to ask them to introduce themselves and talk for about 5 minutes about what it is that they do at their agency and what their particular role is and their agency's role in invasive species. And then we'll go through some Q&A. I'll ask a couple questions of it, and then we'll open up to the audience as well. So to start off, why don't we go with Robbie. Robbie Barbero from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Take it over.
Great, thank you. So my name is Robbie Barbero. I work in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. I cover a broad range of life science and biotech related issues of special relevance for the discussion here today. I've been one of the members of the administration that's been working on our efforts to modernize the regulatory system for biotechnology products. And I could speak for a long period of time about this because this is a large and complicated issue, but the three key points I'd like to hit with this group, and then we can get deeper into it if there are any questions, are that about a year and a half ago, the administration initiated this effort. And we laid out three tasks for ourselves. The first was to revisit a 30-year-old policy document that describes how federal agencies work together to assess the safety of the products of biotechnology. That document had not been updated since 1992, and we felt like it was worthwhile to go through and update it again. And it's important to note that document, which is called the Coordinated Framework for the Regulation of Biotechnology, is intended to be kind of a roadmap for what the various roles and responsibilities of the agencies are as they're assessing products of biotechnology. And since it had not been updated since 1992, what the update effort is to clarify what those current roles and responsibilities are. In the intervening years, each of the agencies had issued their own guidances and rules, in some cases been granted new regulatory authorities, and there had not been any concerted effort to put all of that information into a single place. So that was one of the key things that we did. That we released a draft of that in the earlier part of this fall and asked for the community to give us feedback on what was still unclear about the roles and responsibilities in there. So if you think this panel is exciting, go read that document because it's 80 pages of the information you'll be hearing today, but in greater depth and detail. The second task then that we assigned to ourselves was to ask an outside body of experts to look into the future of biotechnology and tell us what the slate of biotech products might look like in that future, and to help us understand whether there would be any novel risks associated with those products. So the National Academies of Sciences agreed to take on this task, and they have been working over the course of the last year to accomplish that. And they have told us that they anticipate delivering that report at some point in the next few months, although don't know exactly when that'll happen. So, you know, I think that'll be a place where those of you who are interested in what this future of biotechnology products looks like. And, you know, I think my hope is that they spoke with members of this community as well and started to think about what products in this space would look like. That'll be a place to look. And then the third task that we assigned to ourselves was this task of connecting this present, right? So this update, what the current roles and responsibilities are, to the future, what that future set of products looks like. And in order to do that, recognize that there would be quite a bit of work and potentially many years worth of work in order to get ready for those future products of biotechnology. And therefore, to sort of set down an initial set of markers of what those tasks would be, we wrote a 5-year strategic plan. And that plan was released earlier in the fall when we released our update to the coordinated framework. And in there, you will see a list of actions that EPA and FDA and USDA have committed to in order to get ready for those future products of biotechnology. It's important to note that those are not the only things that those agencies will be doing as they learn new information and continue to get feedback from the community. I anticipate that there will continue to be more activities in that space. So that is the short summary of the three things that we've been doing in this space. and look forward to this discussion. Thanks, Mike.
Larry, from USDA APHIS.
Hi, I'm Larry Clark. I'm the director of the National Wildlife Research Center, embedded in all sorts of government acronyms, but APHIS. We're the actually only the research organization within APHIS, which is generally an oversight and a regulatory a group. So what we deal with, we're an R&D laboratory, and we work at the nexus between regulatory issues, sort of technology transfer with private sector or other types of partners, and also developing that. And so we look at human-wildlife conflicts in the broadest sense. And human-wildlife conflicts could encompass invasive species issues. It could encompass issues that relate to wildlife doing things that humans don't like, such as eating crops, perhaps being vectors for disease. It could be humans impacting wildlife in terms of our impacts, of our activities on T&E species. So it's actually a very broad mission area. We're a very small group of scientists together, and we partner with lots of different people on lots of different things. So for example, last year we partnered with 374 different organizations. And the idea behind that is that what our challenge is, as we develop a tool to resolve a conflict, regardless of what that might be, whether it's a vaccine, a pesticide, a management strategy, a device, we try to find the right group of people to take that not only through the R&D phase, but then also to transfer that technology so it can be used by managers and policymakers. And over the years, having made about every mistake possible in that process, we have developed a niche by being a good partner with, let's say, people outside of government working with our regulatory partners. Because if you take a look at vertebrate biology, a lot of the regulations are very specific in terms of biotechnology, for example, or vaccine development, in a very different setting than, let's say, the ecology of wildlife. And we find that that is one of our challenges. We also find the other challenge is that the type of partners, because of the market conditions on wildlife issues, is fairly small. The types of businesses that become involved in that are generally not the large corporations. They're small businesses that don't have the wherewithal in terms of the R&D to take that risk. They don't have the experience to take it through the regulatory process. And that's where we come in this sort of partnership along those lines, to basically enhance those capabilities to run those gauntlets. And we've had some really nice successes over the years along those lines. And we see a lot of the new biotechnology that's being developed for invasive species control, for example, in rodents on islands, as one of those types of situations. But you could apply this eventually down to agricultural interfaces, the agro-ecosystem, as it were. And then what are the sort of constraints and safety valves that we need to consider? Because as we go through a world that's hurling towards 10 billion people in 2050, that pressure in terms of feeding the world is only going to come from a few geographic areas. And anything that could be a detriment to that food production, essentially, and if it involves wildlife, is pretty much going to be under severe pressure. So if we can develop the tools now to mitigate against that, that'll be very good. And my last point, and I think this will be part of the panel discussion because I know the questions were asked for the last two speakers here, is the technology is easy. Yes, it takes time. And even the regulatory process is easy in some respects. It's that social milieu of really what are the belief systems that are out there? We've seen experience with that where the science comes down very heavily on the side of vaccination, and yet critics of vaccination in terms of the relationship between autism persist. Those sorts of issues, just by way of example, are our biggest challenge and where we're going to have the faith. Because, quite frankly, everybody can now access broadly the communication channels. All opinions apparently are equal, no matter how far-fetched. And so, focusing on those issues.
I'm not sure
issues,
why you say that, but you know.
Focusing on those issues really is going to be our challenge, and that's increasingly in my organization. That's what we face. We invent the technologies, we go through the regulatory process, and then getting them utilized and accepted by people is really where we have our greatest challenges ahead of us.
Thank you, Larry. That was really well put. And Ritu, tell us about your role at the FDA and the role of the FDA in this particular space. Why are people, most people I don't think really think about the FDA as an agency that engages in invasive species work.
Okay, so I'm Ritu Nalbola. I'm a senior policy advisor in the Office of Policy in the Commissioner's Office at FDA. And I think most pertinent for this audience and this discussion would be how FDA has a role in the regulation of animals, and specifically genetically engineered animals. And I have actually a couple of my colleagues here from our Center for Veterinary Medicine, if you all have further questions. I'm just gonna generally talk about how FDA regulates genetically engineered animals and how that fits into the coordinated framework for biotechnology that Robbie just talked about. So FDA regulates GE animals, genetically engineered animals, under our new animal drug provisions, and the genetic material, right? So the recombinant DNA construct that's integrated into the DNA of the animal, that's the regulated article, because that's the one that fits into our definition of what a drug is and what a new animal drug is. And we evaluate the safety and effectiveness of the regulated article. As part of our safety evaluations, we look at not only the safety of the article to the animal, but also any food that's derived from that animal. And then for GE animals that may be used to produce, say, medical products like drugs or biological products, we also coordinate within the agency with our medical product centers to look at the safety and effectiveness of the medical product. So we've been working on updating the coordinated framework, as Robbie mentioned. We also have been, the other task, I think specifically the national strategy, looking into the future, what types of newer biotechnologies may be used in FDA-regulated products, and whether and how FDA can be better equipped and prepared for these newer techniques and newer products that may be derived from those technologies. There's a lot of thought that went into it, and some of the concerns that we heard from our stakeholders about increasing predictability of the regulatory systems, reducing regulatory uncertainty. We've considered all of those comments, and in the document, the national strategy that was issued in September, there are some key commitments that FDA has made. And so one of the key messages, if not anything that I would leave this audience with, is that by releasing the two documents back in September, it's not that our work has been completed. It's a series, it's an ongoing work. We do have a lot of stakeholders' comments that we are considering. And among the commitments that we've made in the strategy document, two that I think will be most relevant to this audience has to do with the use of genome editing, gene editing, the gene drives that you heard from the previous speaker, and whether and how that fits into our regulatory frameworks, and be committed to, you know, considering that issue further and providing some clarification going into the future. Also with respect to insects, genetically engineered insects, particularly with mosquitoes, one of the things we've said in that document is that FDA is working with EPA and also APHIS, looking at our existing authorities to see how we can delineate and better explain and clarify our roles and responsibilities. And to the extent there are claims that are made with respect to mosquitoes for population control, whether that fits into the pesticide provisions, and for any disease claims, how that might fit into our new animal drug provision. So these are all things that we are looking at, and we've said in the document, and I will reiterate that this is an area that we are considering, and we expect to provide clarification going into the future.
Thank you very much. Sure. Mike Mendelson from the EPA.
Yeah, hi. So I'm Mike Mendelson. I'm in the EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs, and so our group assesses the risk and looks at the registration or licensing of pesticides, as well as assessing the safety of residues in food of pesticides and issuing tolerances or permissible residue levels for those. Currently, I'm managing the group in the Office of Pesticide Programs that assesses the risks and licenses or registers biopesticides, and these include microbial pesticides and also biotech-related pesticides, such as the plant-incorporated protectants and genetically engineered microbes. endangered species. I mean, as Ritu mentioned about the coordinated framework update, we were involved with that as well, and we made a number of commitments in the strategy document. One of those is our group is going to be reorganizing in the next several months so we can focus more on biotechnology with an emerging technologies group. We also plan on providing greater clarification of our oversight of gene editing, and as she also mentioned about how we're looking at, we're working closely with our colleagues at FDA and at the Department of Agriculture with regard to genetically engineered insects.
Great. Thanks so much, Mike. And last but not least is Earl Campbell from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah, let me just introduce myself a little bit further. I work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I run a small program working on invasive species in Honolulu, and we have a broader oversight of a range of areas within the tropical Pacific. I think an important thing with my role, and also I think how my role was founded many years ago, is if you look at the major thing that causes the decline in species in the area I work, it's invasive species. And you look at what we're spending the most money on, it's probably things like fencing or development of tools for invasive species control or implementing it. So key thing with my role is I lead a small group, I provide a lot of technical assistance on a range of taxa and issues broadly in the area I work. My background, you know, I've done a fair bit of regulatory work, primarily for the Fish and Wildlife Service dealing with Section 7. In more recent years, I have a fair bit of experience in NEPA, but again, I'm the type of person who receives the recommendations that you guys give me on how to implement it. And I think one of the key things that I found exciting because of a number of the questions that I've been getting is that the national strategy and the updated to the coordinated framework has been rolled out. With new technologies have been generating questions for me from people who are interested in using them, and I didn't have answers. And that's a good place for me to lean to say people are looking to develop things. So when I look at sort of my role with the development of things, as I mentioned in my talk, there are a number of technologies that I'm very interested in trying to get online, landscape-level mosquito control, and some ways to get that implemented. Over the years, as a researcher, I've developed techniques, but also more recently, I'm the funder within my agency in many cases of the researchers or the people doing things. So I'm looking at how do we get things rolled out. The greatest challenge that I see, and I think it goes back to something Larry stated, is the term social milieu or social license. And I can invest a fair bit into a technology, but if I don't have the public supporting its implementation, it may not be used at all. Or if I don't have it developed in a manner that folks that are working as operators in the field can understand how to use it well, maybe my investment won't be used. So a key thing I look at is public education and social license are key factors.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So we've got about a half an hour to go through some questions. And I know the audience members are gonna have a good number of questions for folks up here. But I want to start off with, a very basic point. We've been talking up here about a lot of biological controls particularly in the area of biotechnology and the regulation of biotechnology. And the purpose for that is because we have about 30 years of experience now with the coordinated framework. So, Robbie, what lessons do we draw from 30 years of experience with one type of technology when we've got an avalanche of new technologies that are really being applied in fantastic ways? You've seen a tremendous amount of that today. What kind of lessons can we take from that 30 years, and how do we apply them proactively to make sure that the technologies that you're seeing today don't get hung up in the regulatory system and that we don't add insult to the injury of market failure that Larry spoke about?
So I think that's a great question. And I actually think that we have this amazingly complicated federal system in the United States. There are, you know, even just in the portfolio in which I operate, which is, you know, broadly life sciences, dozens and dozens of agencies that either fund research in that space or do their own research in that space or regulate products or regulate research in that space. And that often can be quite overwhelming to the uninitiated. I can certainly say when I first got to the White House, it was very, very overwhelming to me. However, from the perspective of answering your very specific question, I think there is an advantage here. And that is, these agencies and departments were all created over the course of time in order to deal with specific problems. And especially on the regulatory side of things, agencies were created in order to address specific problems in certain areas, right? So one thing that I often hear people say is, oh, it would be so much easier if we just had a single agency that regulated all of biotechnology. And while that's, you know, on the one hand, it would certainly be easier for someone who's saying, where do I go talk to the person who regulates biotechnology? All they would have to do is look for that agency. It would be immensely challenging because that agency would have to regulate products across a very large number of application areas, right? So if you wanted to find out, you know, is the food that I'm making, you know, who do I need to talk to make sure about the safety of my food? The great news is we have a food and drug agency, right? So you can go talk to that agency and they can help you understand. And this is not, you know, what you heard from Ritu today was talking about the role they play in regulating products of biotechnology. But the great thing is they also look at foods made through all means and grown in a variety of different ways. I think the same thing is true for Fish and Wildlife Service. You're not thinking about a specific technology on any given day. You're thinking about the mission area of your agency. Or if you go to USDA, they're thinking about the mission area of their agency. So there's a bit of wisdom in the way that this system is constructed in that if you are a drone operator or thinking about some crazy new way of using information technology in order to solve a problem, you think about the application area that you're working in and then you go talk to that agency and they can help you figure out whether it's the right way to do it.
Ritu, how does an innovator know when to come to the FDA? When do you do that? At what stage does someone who's developing a new technology that may come under the purview of your agency, do they engage?
So we have several mechanisms for developers to engage with us. Of course, there's more or less formal types of mechanisms where they can contact us and we can have some consultations early on. Pretty much each one of our regulatory processes has mechanisms for early consultations with the developers. But in terms of basic information, what does FDA do? Is FDA the right agency for me to go to for this product? There's a lot of information on our website. Granted, it's not always all that user-friendly. But again, these are all things that we have been thinking about. One of the things we did mention in the strategy document is to really emphasize this importance of communication, public communication and public engagement. And so there are definitely activities that are identified in the strategy document for agencies, including FDA, to do better with making our information more accessible, more easy for developers to understand. We also have specific activities for small businesses. But also generally explaining to consumers and other stakeholders what it is that we do, how do we reach our decisions. There's plenty of information on our website, but definitely room for us to do better.
Is that part of the point of the update of the coordinated framework to improve part of that?
So I think the entire effort related to the coordinated framework had very specific goals. One of them was really to clarify what it is that the different agencies, the three primary regulatory agencies, do. And so the update to the coordinated framework, which we issued in draft form, has this enormous table. And looking at the table, I think, is really...
What is the table of?
It's a table. It's a two-dimensional matrix with different types of source organisms that are potentially, that could be genetically engineered, right? So you have plants, animals, and microbes. And for each of those source organisms, there are different applications, pesticides, food, or drugs, and medical devices, for example, or biologics. So if you look at the matrix, you'll see the complexity of the framework itself,
right?
Which agency has a role for which organism, for which application. And I think that's really the intent of the update, is to provide that sort of clarification. But the second aspect was about the strategy, was where, you know, we took a closer look at what are the areas where we agencies can do better, both in terms of increasing transparency, predictability, but also strengthening our regulatory science programs. And I think that's the intent of that second document.
Excellent, thank you. Mike, how does the EPA do horizon scanning to know how to even prepare for applications that are going to come into your agency? How do you actually go about doing that, and then how do you communicate the results of what you guys look at to the public?
Great. Yeah, so we constantly are looking at the literature and also relying, we're looking forward to this upcoming National Academies study that'll be coming out. As far as communicating to the public what we look at, we have transparency is one of the cornerstones of our biotechnology program, and throughout the process, we have various points where we share what we're doing with the public. When we receive applications, we put that in the Federal Register. Before we make regulatory decisions, we put our proposed decisions on the website to allow for public comment. Those proposed decisions also have the risk assessments as part of them as well. And so we're constantly seeking public input in our processes.
Absolutely. So, Larry, you made an excellent point earlier that it's not just the market failures that you see where we've seen a lack of investment in innovation to address invasive species, but in addition to that, that often these are small-scale operations that don't have experience with the regulatory agencies or with commercialization and tech transfer. So if you had your druthers, what would be the most important thing that we could do to address that? How do you actually get it so that the scientists who are innovating at a smaller level can actually make it through that through the regulatory agencies? We've heard a number of stories about how the regulatory system has stifled innovation. Okay, fine. What are the levers that we need to pull to fix that, particularly as it applies to tech transfer and commercialization?
Yeah, I think the keys are we need to provide people with a map and a compass, and then a network. And those aren't really possible without outreach from the government agencies themselves. So, and I know ARS does this, we certainly do it as well. It's that outreach. A couple of examples of sort of partnerships is really what it involves, is that often people don't know who their partner is going to be when they start out in this process. If it's a small business, through whatever mechanism, serendipity or even a very focused approach, somebody has an idea. Or they heard something over the news, then they catch it and they call you from out of the blue. Good examples, Earl brought up the broadcast bait delivery system for brown tree snakes. I was at a luncheon at an awards banquet for innovation for the governor of Colorado, for example, and the person sat next to me in this small business opportunity. But unfortunately, that's really where we are often. It's serendipity and stochasticity.
What tools do we need?
The tools that we need are better outreach for the government laboratories that do R&D, because a lot of these small businesses, as I said, don't have the wherewithal to take on the risk of research. And if the research is broad enough in an area of public good, that's where federal laboratories come in, is that they inherently take on risk of the research aspect of it. And getting that technology then transferred and properly partnered is an enterprise that actually goes on, but probably not broadly enough. And really, it's because people don't know about the opportunities that arise. And I think those sort of networks, because the partners that you need basically perhaps a federal laboratory that has some R&D capacity, you need the private sector. You actually, when you get to a certain stage of development, Rather than...
What do you mean by a network?
A network could be...
We all recognize that the Federal Register is a really important mechanism for communicating with people.
A network could be a trade association. A network could be an industry function. A network could be a meeting like this.
This could be the start.
This is a network.
Good.
And really, because what happens is in a conversation, in a presentation, those connections are made. A connection that you never thought about. I often make the joke that when I meet people is that they don't know they're about to become wildlife biologists.
Because
many of our partners had no clue that they were going to be, that there was a market in wildlife biology, and that it was in a problem. But they have an expertise. So it's incumbent upon all of us. It's not just on the private sector, it's up to us to look for those opportunities to what are our potential networks? Where's our gap analysis?
Indeed.
And then how do we go out and get that?
I think actually you make a good point. Engaging with federal agencies is often challenging for people who have never done it before. Federal labs are a great way to get started in those conversations, especially on the science and technology side of things, because those are the labs that are operating more like a non-federal entity than a lot of other pieces of the government. And there are a whole bunch of federal labs across many departments and agencies. Interestingly enough, there is actually a federal lab consortium. And so you can go in and start to dig around a little bit and say, where are the federal labs that are close to me or that are in areas that I operate? And you can have conversations with researchers in federal labs, and that can be sort of a gateway into the conversations with other part of the government. So then, that's how you find people like Larry or others. There are a lot of people in the Agricultural Research Service, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which is just up the road a little bit, has labs like that. I often encourage people to start with those conversations because they can help you then bridge the gap into other funding agencies or into regulatory agencies.
Earl, we have heard a number of people talk about this issue of social license or the acceptance of the technology by the public and how important it is to engage them, particularly when you're going to be using these technologies in and around the areas that they live or care about. What types of tools do you think federal agencies need to develop or improve upon in order to do that well? Because we are seeing really a lot of very, very new technologies that are going to be scary to some people, and particularly because there are people out there specifically saying that these are scary. So how do we actually engage in a rational conversation around this when you're with a locality? This is something you obviously do.
Yeah, I'm thinking a little bit about, and the way I set up my talk was to give you past lessons learned and then looking at present things that I'm working on. And one of the key things that I've learned over time where I've failed or my peers have failed is we didn't invest enough in general public education, not only in the technology, but actually on the net result that we want. If my goal is to save birds, I really need to be telling people why I want to save birds, and that's a net outcome, or I want to save OHIA. Those cultural components that people can associate and they grip are key. And if I can get somebody to understand that, and then I say to them, and we're going to be using a certain technology, they know the goal, and we've set up some communication, and there's a degree of trust and agreement on an end goal. So I do look at, currently, there's an underinvestment in public education, in many cases, in implementing technologies. The other thing that I think, when I look at what we're doing that's different with...
Do we know what kind of public education works in this case?
In some cases, we do, actually.
We heard from Oxitec, who had engaged in the public successfully in a number of countries now. But this seems like the kind of challenge that comes up almost every election cycle, where you get a strong anti-GMO contingency, and in some cases, anti-technology contingency, who have their hearts in the right place. They want to protect the environment. So how do you actually engage, or do you engage folks who hold deep concerns about these technologies, and can you actually sway minds?
Well, I think first and foremost, a lot of folks do want to avoid engagement in people that disagree with them.
Usually,
and I think that's really problematic.
That's why Robbie's sitting down there.
I think, you know, when I look at, for instance, the hunting community, one of the key things that I think is really important is to have, I need to know what the people that disagree with me are believing in. And in many cases, there are a subset of people that communicate well, and having the communication back and forth, even though you may inherently disagree on certain points, really helps. Because one of the things that we heard when OxyTech talked was, you know, you have a lot of problems where people are saying mistruths. One of the key things is when you have trust between individuals, a lot of times you can try to clarify those things with people that you may disagree with them, but at least they want to have what's real out there for the discussion. You want to disagree on things that are in reality. I also want to step back and say that the areas that I think we've had the most effective public education in Hawaii is basically through multi-agency groups where we put in funds to a group called the Coordinating Agency on Alien Pest Species. And the individual running that is a wonderful public educator. It's a broad group. And really, she knows how to, because she's done it for so many years, how we engage communities well with controversy. And also, she does things like surveys to find out what is the background support or disagreement on things, or what we need to target from a language basis, or where are we missing our mark. So pre-surveys are really important. And I also think doing it years in advance. So when we're looking at the mosquito issue, we may be rolling out or looking at technologies over a period of time, but we've recognized after actually having quite a number of defeats or mistakes that we need to get that engagement going immediately, full force. And that's where we really would like to have the greatest investment, because we need to know how to move these technologies forward if we're going to invest in them.
I think the other thing to keep in mind, sorry.
That's good.
Sure? Yeah. Oh, thank you, sir. I think the other thing to keep in mind is it's really not about, you know, saying this is how we're going to fix the problem first. It's about saying what is the problem and what are the outcomes we desire, and then looking across the board and saying what are the ways of fixing this problem. I mean, I think that's one of the places where you can avoid falling into a lot of the traps. So that's a point that Earl made, but I think it's really important to say that, right? Like, let's agree on what those desired outcomes are first and have a conversation about those. And some of the presentations that we saw today did a nice job of talking about that. You know, there's rarely only one way to accomplish things. Sometimes there is only one way, but often there are many ways.
You know, in our experience, community forums can have a value. I mean, you certainly need to do that in terms of getting information out in a general sense. But often our biggest successes, and we're just going through one process right now, where it has the USGS invented a Sylvatic plague vaccine. Uh-huh. Fish and Wildlife Service has their safe harbor agreement. We've been supporting them on the registration side and the technology transfer side. But the real issue is that plague kills prairie dogs, and prairie dogs are black-footed ferret food. But you need to grow more prairie dogs, but Western ranchers aren't particularly fond of prairie dogs. And so it's an elaborate system, but really what's made this system work is the proper set of rewards and engagement, but it's word of mouth, case studies. The people embedded in the community who had skin in the game and saw the value in it actually then talked to their neighbors. And then it has sort of this exponential growth organically, as opposed to the government telling them what's good for them. So basically, what do people value? Okay, what's in it for them? The stewards of the lands, the ranchers, aren't necessarily opposed, and as long as they can see that there's value in it for them, and then their neighbors talk to them, that actually is where we've had the most success in all of our transfers, is those case studies and testimonials. And you strategically go through that, because we have a very large operational program. They know their community. And so you start at the grassroots and let them be your spokespeople, as opposed to us being essentially the lecturers.
We've got about 11 minutes left in this, and I want to make sure that the audience gets an opportunity to ask a couple questions as well. Go ahead, sir. Nice and loud. I'll repeat the question for folks that can't hear.
At what time of the process you guys intend to engage Native American tribes, being the second land managers in the United States? as a consultation from a government to government.
Go ahead.
So I think first I just want to clarify so that my remarks are taken in the right context. So what FDA has committed to doing is with respect to genome editing and genetically engineered insects is to clarify our policies in that area. We're not, at this time, did not say anything in the document about seeking new legislation in those areas, but really to provide guidance to developers on how they can meet the regulatory and obligations and requirements with respect to using these newer technologies in FDA-regulated product areas, right? So that said, I think your question about Native American and you know engaging Native American tribes, and we do policies in place through the department as well as within the agency for our regulatory actions. We do have to implement the tribal policies, and we have consultations. My most recent experience has been in the food safety area in that, and so I know we have a specific mechanism in place, and that actually is, we go through that process for our regulatory actions. And then also want to mention that, because I didn't earlier, but as part of our evaluations of new animal drug provisions, we do have obligations under the National Environmental Policy Act, where we look at the potential environmental impacts for any of our significant regulatory actions.
What's the, just so people understand, what's the FDA's role in NEPA, specifically?
Yeah, so I think for there's NEPA instructs the agencies to consider impacts to the environment, human environment, for major actions, and there are, and we have under NEPA, then we have implementing regulations that are in the FDA CFR. So we look at the potential impacts to the environment for our regulatory actions, and in that process, we actually interact with Fish and Wildlife Services, National Marine Fisheries Service, and other agencies as needed.
Thank you. Sir?
I guess my question is directed towards Dr. Barbera. For the last 6 months, in Science Magazine, every week, you can order a kit to knock out any gene using CRISPR-Cas9. Kit's pretty cheap. There's no regulation about getting it. Within the last month, Jennifer Doudna, who is the main inventor of the CRISPR-Cas9 technology, has published a book about how to apply CRISPR-Cas9 to your own organism, any plant or animal. It's not an expensive book, and it really tells you exactly how to do this, and I imagine thousands of people have bought it. Has not this technology, to some extent, escaped the possibility of regulation? Is there a regulatory context that can deal with individuals buying the technology and using it? I could do it in my own laboratory, according to Doudna's book.
So are you talking specifically about in the context of invasive species, or is this a general question about biotechnology and who is using it and how they're using it?
I guess my question is in the context of invasive species. I can imagine other contexts in which the same question could arise. It's the easy availability now and decreasing cost of using gene editing technology.
So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a concept that's been pretty widely discussed in the last few years. I would say I haven't seen a clear set of data that says, you know, now people who could never do this before can do it now. I thought there was an interesting article from one of the journalists, it was either Science or Nature at some point in the last few months, where they said, you know, this is someone who had a science degree but hadn't done lab work in several decades. Do you know which one I'm talking about? And said, actually, it's not as easy as everyone says it is, right? So, and it was a fascinating sort of blow-by-blow of this person who was a scientist but hadn't done it in a long time. If you haven't read the article, you should. I will spoil it for you. They are not successful in the very trivial genetic engineering feat that they try to accomplish in the lab with a sophisticated user standing over their shoulder, guiding them, you know, with all of the tools and materials that a lab had.
Now, it's also an important point to make on that the agencies don't regulate technologies per se, but products.
Right. So that being, you know, that being said, there are quite a few sort of guidelines and rules out there that especially that the research agencies have propagated in order to ensure that people are following appropriate safety rules and in a, you know, and using these things in research contexts. You know, for sure, if you are building a product in this space that you intend to either commercially sell or, you know, or release, and you're going to be operating in a space where one of these regulatory agencies operate, it would well behoove you to speak to them prior to the release of that organism.
I have a very quick question. We only have one more, a couple minutes left. The elephant in the room on the work that you all have been doing on the coordinated framework and in regulatory reform and evolution, as well as the executive order that came out today, is that in not so long a Trump administration is going to take over not just the White House but the federal agencies, of course. And in the course of doing that, they're going to have different priorities. Do you think that's going to have a substantial effect on the efforts that you've been driving to date and on the implementation of the order that we saw today?
So I can tell you what the official word is on those kind of actions, and that is that, you know, we do not have the ability to speak for the next administration. You heard the president say in the Rose Garden the day after the election.
I can translate bureaucrat. He means yes, that you should be concerned.
you heard the president say in the Rose Garden the day after the election and this is guidance that we've gotten internally as well, that we are to do everything that we can in order to ensure that the next administration is as well prepared as possible in order to be able to execute on the goals for the American people. To the extent that that is includes items that we've been working on, you know, we certainly will be sharing our list of accomplishments and priorities with them, just like we do with those of you who are not a part of a part of the government.
I actually think there's another part of this and so because we're running out of time, I'll just cue it up for someone to either agree or disagree with me on, is that the actions that you all have been involved with, including the order today, are not inconsistent with either political party's point of view. Invasive species cost money and harm the environment, and that affects everyone. So I don't think that necessarily in this case that we will see a full stop to these activities, but they may evolve. True, false, am I out of my mind to think that we might be in danger here?
Not speaking for the next administration, but I think investment certainly would be a high priority. So if it could be couched in those terms, I think, you know, it really is just a business model. Okay, why are we doing this?
Right.
You know, what's our return back on that? Mm-hmm. And regardless of administrations, that's always been an emphasis. So I don't think that'll change.
I think it's a great answer. And with that, thank you all very much, the panel members, for this. I appreciate it. I don't know if you all be staying for the reception afterwards, yes. But if you are, I'm sure there are lots of people here who have questions for you. Thank you all again.